Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall. Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. After a brief intro, I'll be joined by a flock, a gaggle, a murder, a group of Germans. First, Alex Trigg and I discuss Martell in 2.0, then Helmut and I chat about the release of the rules documents for 2nd edition. Lastly, Florian helps me discuss the one we've all been waiting for, the new FAQ. So, episode 25, and as you can probably tell from the fact that I had to do a terrible job on the table of contents, I've been abandoned by my co-host once again. Actually, he's out in New York City testing with a group of people for Gen Con. I wasn't able to tag along. I'm actually quite jealous of him, but I've been doing a fair bit of testing this weekend as well because, well, we'll get to that later. We were going to release an episode slightly later, but given that it's been a huge week for news, I decided I wouldn't keep you waiting. We're going to give you a nice, full, even slightly longer than usual episode, but since you probably don't want to listen to just me ramble on without John, I'll keep the intro fairly brief. First of all, before last weekend of regionals ended, and I have results from Sacramento, which was won by a Targ Knights of the Hollow Hill, and from Chicago, which was won by an HOD Maiden's Bane that beat out a Stark Siege. I didn't get any news out of Morgantown or Seattle. Obviously, this has been, as I said, a big week for news. We got the Martell article announced, and then an official confirmation that the Tyrell article would be coming on Monday, because that wasn't mentioned in the Martell article. The Martell article had the rules documents, which were everything I could have hoped for. And we got the FAQ as well on Wednesday. My gripes about that are for a separate segment as well. However, it's worth noting that the first version of the FAQ that was posted seemed to have omitted the erratum for Knights of the Hollow Hill that said that you had 5 more cards at your command. And that wasn't highlighted in red, and it wasn't highlighted as a change, but it looked like it was missing. It turns out that was a mistake. The FAQ has since been updated. That's been put back in. So if in the last couple of days you were frantically building Knights of the Hollow Hill decks, hoping to be able to use, you know, the Stark Sansa or whatever it was, I'm sorry to crush your dreams. Before I jump on, I have one last item to touch on. It's that we're getting very, very close to Gen Con. The Gen Con joust of 128 tickets, there are 25 left. So it definitely looks like that's going to be sold out. I would get your tickets online now. Don't chance it. Don't wait for the last minute. They may not be able to squeeze you in with all the other events they're running this year. For Melee, however, quite a few tickets left. 73 out of 128. Doesn't look like it's going to be as popular, but it does have a card design on the line, so my odds just improved. There's obviously nothing left for the Kingslayer. All 232 tickets have been sold out. I haven't seen them add any new ones, and I don't see them doing so. Alright, we're joined today by Alex Trigg, the first of 3 Germans to be on the show today. Well, actually, do you count yourself as German? Or?
Well, it depends on the political situation. At the moment, I think I'm more German.
More German than Greek. Okay, alright.
Well, with the crisis and stuff, you know.
Alright, so you're playing it safe. You're German this week. Alright. The reason that I tried to pester you to come talk to us is that you are sort of thought of as the founding father of some very negative play experience Martell decks. Would you say that's a fair assessment?
Well, actually, no, because I never played combo decks. I mean, I like abusing the deck like Bloodthirst. I liked drawing all of my deck, but I still like to win with challenges.
So you're still playing the same game as us, just on a completely different level.
Well, you can put it that way.
Yeah, right. We'll go with that. So I guess I've always associated House Martell as your house. I figured you'd be a good guest to talk about the spoiler article we got for Martell in 2nd edition. Any first glance, first thoughts, first impressions?
Well, first of all, I love the artwork. I really like the artwork on the cards, like Dastan Gray or Sunspear or Ariane. They're really beautiful. And from the mechanics, I think it looks like it's going to be much more Nedley. And I really like that. I really like the card design I read still now. And I also really like the article. I mean, it's really nicely put. And yeah, I mean, I really wanted to see the Viper. I mean, I love House Martell. As you said, I think it's my house. And yeah, I'm definitely looking forward to playing it in Agua 2.
I do think that the color palette that they chose was very nice. Not only that the logo was in a circle, where a lot of the others is in a shield, but also the change, it's not as orange as it was in first edition. I think that was a wise decision just for color overall.
Yeah, the cards are much more beautiful. I mean, in Agua 1, the cards, I don't know, I don't like the card designs in most Martell cards. I mean, they have the Red Vengeance, which is very nice, and Viper's Rage maybe, and the Viper, of course, the one no one plays.
the Warcrest one?
Yeah. Well, let's see now, but no, I think it's really beautiful and really well done.
Now, one of the themes that they're sort of talking about, both in the article and that the cards are clearly trying to express, is this idea that if you play the waiting game, you know, the more plots are in your use pile, the more Dawn gives strength, the more power you get from Doran's game, the more Doran himself gives strength. And I know that when we talked to Florian about this a couple of weeks ago, he thought that this was a little too on the nose. It was forcing you to play a long game rather than the cards sort of suggesting you should. But what I really like about it is that there's that turnover point on turn 7, right? On turn 7, you flip your 7th plot, suddenly you've lost all of that advantage.
I think it's very meddly. I mean, if you think about the Martells in the books, they are a bit like that. I mean, they have long plans. Sometimes they fail. Like the Quentin quest and stuff, but no, I really like it. And I think, I don't know, maybe we'll see some plot cycling later on, which
so
really
you could
fits
time it a little
theme.
Bit. Yeah.
So I think it's a nice theme. And as I said, it's very Nedley, I think.
Well, I think the Quentin example is excellent because there's a line in the books where I think it's Barristan who tells Quentin, had you showed up a little bit earlier, things would have been completely different, right? Danny would still have been there and everything would have changed. So really, he showed up on plot 7. Had he showed up on plot 6, he'd have gotten it. Martell would have won the game. Same thing with the Red Viper. Like, he's in the fight. He just waits a little too long, right?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I really like it. Well, I don't think it's very strong. I mean, at least in the beginning, I don't think it's going to be very strong. But, I mean, think about it. Right now, we don't have a Valar. At least it's not spoiled yet. Mm-hmm. So I think it makes sense. I mean, it's possible that you have your key characters on the board for many plots. So I think it will work out fine.
Yeah.
I don't think it's overpowered, but I think it's good. I mean, and we have to see all the cards. I mean, right now we don't have all the card pool to know, but in general, yeah, I like it. I like it, and I think it's gonna be nice.
Now, maybe we should dig into a few of the cards. For me, the cards that we've seen so far are very, very binary. I either see cards that I think are absolutely amazing, like Ariane and Gaston, or that I think are pretty weak, like the Red Viper himself. Now, we'll talk about him specifically afterwards. But for me, Ariane's ability to, you know, participate in a challenge, then jump in someone else, or we know ladies can be reduced by that plot, so you could use her for 3 and then get in a 5-cost character instead. And the fact that Gaston Grey, you can't be saved from its effect. All you have to do is lose a challenge. It's a really good tempo play, despite the fact that it's Neyland Sacrifice to get it in there. I think those are just amazing cards, and the kinds of cards that we associate with the Princes of the Sun box. Like, those cards are just that good.
No, I think the cards are very strong. I mean, if you look exactly as you said, as Gaston Grey, and I mean, it's a cost 2 location, but if 2 is like 1 gold, think about if we had this card in Agot 1, it would be really strong. I mean, think about Gaston Grey in Agot 1. It's a very strong card. And if you look at Sunspear, the same thing. I mean, you're paying 2 gold and you get claim 2. It's a very strong card. And yeah, Ariane definitely is going to be nice, especially when the card pool gets bigger and you can really surprise your opponent with a lot of different characters, maybe even with characters that have enter play mechanics. That's also very interesting that if you look at her text, it's not the Martell character. So you can put maybe out-of-house characters with cost 5 into play.
Although that's not as much of a difference as in first edition, where you're not ignoring an out-of-house penalty here.
Yeah.
So it's not a cost savings in that case, although you probably have more reducers for Martell if you're playing a Martell deck, you know.
Yeah.
So I guess that makes a difference. So let's talk about the ones that I think are a little bit weaker, and that's cards like Doran and the Red Viper and, you know, so the ones that are somewhat reinforcing this theme. Or actually, before we do, let's talk about one card that I think is absolutely insane, because I forgot that one was in the spoiler article. Doran's Game. What are your thoughts on Doran's Game?
Well, as they said in the article, It's like you are at 5 power and suddenly you're at 15, something like that. I mean, it's a combo card, which can definitely give you a lot of power very fast. I think it's quite strong. And it's the unexpected thing. I mean, you do the challenge and your opponent just opposes with a weenie or something, and suddenly you get like 5 power from it if you're at the 6th block. I mean, I think it's a very strong event, and especially for 1 gold cost only.
Yeah, I mean,
and it's max 1 per challenge. Oh, well, it needs an intrigue charm, so yeah, you can only do it once per phase. But still, I think it's quite good. I think it's quite good.
Well, you can win on defense as well.
Yeah.
Potentially.
Yeah.
So it's got that versatility. But to me, this is a card. I suspect that in the first sort of year of play, this card will be fine. It'll make its way into some decks. It'll frequently be gaining you 3-4 power, sometimes 5. It'll be nice. But it'll sit dead in your hand for a couple of rounds. So it's not all that broken. But I think that once you can get the control elements to the point where you can reliably time your offense on plot 5 or 6, this is just going to be such a strong card.
Exactly. That was what I was saying. Thinking about also about the Viper, for example. I think that right now those cards don't seem so strong. But exactly, if like after 1 year, if you have like 2 cycles out or 3 cycles out, and you have like a very competitive and good working deck, like my old Blackthirst deck, for example, where you can time when you're going to win and where you're going to drop everything and go for the win, I think this event could be huge. Yeah.
Well, the Viper has been somewhat controversial in that people are talking about how you can, you know, get him to 75 power and win the strength and win the game, which, you know, is not how you not how that's going to happen. The good stuff about him, he's definitely 7 cost, 7 strength. That's the highest we've seen in the game. He's a Tricon. We have not seen very many Tricons. In fact, I think we've only seen Euron and Tywin, both of whom have less strength. So he's not inherently a bad board presence. And if you're going to milk him, he's still a 7 cost, 7 strength Tricon, which is, again, still strong. But that reaction, it will be renown often enough. It'll be slightly worse and slightly better often enough to be roughly equivalent to renown, I think.
Well, I think that especially in the beginning, it won't be very strong. But think about something else. First of all, he's nearly unburnable with 7 strength, at least from the cards we've seen now, which is very important. And the other thing is, what if you can stand him? I mean, I think we saw a card with some standing tokens.
Yes.
Imagine if he can do 2 or 3 challenges with him. Then the effect is much stronger.
Right. That's true. He doesn't have a limit once per phase. He can, for every challenge in which he can participate as an attacker, you have the threat of his reaction.
Exactly, and as I also said on the forums, I mean, yeah, it's like the attachment Viserys. I mean, in the beginning, he was a crappy card, but right now you can build a Targaryen Hollow Hill deck with 50 attachments and Viserys, and you can win plot 2. So I think that, yeah, right now the Viper doesn't seem so strong, but maybe later he will get stronger. Maybe there are going to be cards that can boost the strength of a character a lot. Like, for example, the Lannister Trebuchet, for example, which gives plus 6 for every character, for every card in your hand. I think that he can be good. And yeah, as you said, I mean, the base stats, the 7 strength with 3 icons, I definitely think he's going to be good. And if we think about the cards Martell has now as control cards, like icon removal and stuff, if they get the same cards in Aga 2, I don't think it's going to be that hard to trigger his response and gain 2 or 3 power.
I think he's got scalability, and that you're right. As the card pool grows, he might eventually hit that critical strut. Which maybe that's the sort of Nedley within a Nedley. They're making Martell the faction that, in the long run of the card pool, will also be the good one. But then it'll hit rotation on cycle 8, and then Martell will be crap again. But that would be quite interesting.
I hope not. I hope Martell's going to be strong from the beginning. But, well, you know, it's all speculations at the moment. I mean, we'll have to play the game to see. And also, I mean, think about the interaction between the houses. If I'm not wrong, I think that House Tyrell was the house which had some effects with strength boosts, right?
That is correct, yeah. So we've seen some.
So maybe that's something that is going to be possible, that you play like Martell with Tyrells and you have some strength bonuses added to work into. Well, we'll have to see. And I mean, if you look at Doran's effect, it's the same thing. He says Lord and Lady, so you're going to need a lot of Lord and Ladies to make him worth it. That's one thing I'm a bit scared, because it's Martell, Lord and Ladies. I mean, how many Lord and Ladies do Martell actually have?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can dig through a lot of, you know, nobody knows them Lords of Martell castles that you've never heard of. But I see what you mean. I mean, currently we have Doran, who doesn't affect himself. We have Ariane, who gets the strength boost, but that's probably not going to make a huge difference for her. We have the Red Viper himself as a lord. And then we have Edric Dayne, who was spoiled by Team Covenant. Did you see that card?
Yeah.
So what do you think of that Edric Dayne, actually? I think he's a really interesting design, but I'm curious to think what you think of him power level.
Well, he's quite versatile. He's quite cheap. I mean, 2 costs for stealth. And,
but he has no icons to start with, right? So you have to give him, pay the gold to give him the icon you want to use that stealth. But he is a lord, and he is House Dayne, so he can also pick up Dawn, for instance.
As you said, I think he's going to scale. Yeah, alone right now, he doesn't seem that awesome, but maybe as the card will grow larger, he's going to be good. And yeah, combined with Doran, I mean, could be quite strong. And I don't know. I mean, right now, we haven't seen that many keywords. So I don't know how important stealth is going to be. You know, right now, Martell has like tons of stealth, but we don't know if in Agua 2, the keywords are going to be as frequent as they are right now.
Well, we've seen quite a lot of stealth in Greyjoy so far, because we saw Theon and Asha both had stealth.
Yeah, but in Martell not. That's what I mean. Martell, they don't have so many keywords until now, so maybe that stealth is going to be really, really good. Another card I would like to mention is the Unbound and Benai Broken. I really love that card. I really love it. And it's really nice to at last see the card with the house words having a really nice card. I mean, I got one, we had the crappy Unbound and Benai Broken. And now we have this, and it's a really nice card. I mean, being able to make your opponent not declare a challenge is really nice.
And it's a zero-cost event. What struck me as weird, though, is that it's not loyal. Not because of the power level or the other stuff. I mean, obviously it plays into Martell's themes and so on. But if there's one event you'd expect to be loyal, it would be your house words.
Yeah, that's true.
We haven't seen a lot of draw out of Martell, period. In fact, the only draw that we've seen in this article is the insight on Doran. Yeah. And a lot of people have sort of knocked Doran as not being all that good, myself included in this. But it might be that insight is much better than we give it credit for, because we've only seen it so far on Samwell Tarly and Daenerys herself. Yeah, but in Stark it was Summer gave Bran insight.
Yeah. And not all the cards have been spoiled. I mean, I hope that Martell gets some draw, because if you're going for the long game, you're going to need draw, of course.
You're going to need fuel.
To set up your combos and stuff.
Yeah, because it doesn't look
maybe
like
they get an agenda again for draw, which would be nice.
I bet if you win Stalic or something, you'll be designing a Martell draw agenda. It might even be called Bloodthirst.
Well, yeah, probably.
So there's one last card that I'd like us to talk about, and this is our exclusive spoiler for the week. So would you care to read out the spoiler?
Yeah, I would love to. So we got Ario Hotta. He's a character, cost strength, military icon, 5 strength, and his text is, he has ambush 5, reaction. After Ario Hotta enters play during a challenge, choose a participating character and remove it from the challenge.
And the flavor text, someone told. Someone always tells. I like that. I think it's a nice, it closes off the card, because it's exactly what the card is trying to do. Just show up in the middle of your secret plan and mess with it.
Yeah, I definitely like him. He might be a very strong card, especially in the beginning of the game, where you're going to need those key characters like Victarion or Euron or Cersei or Tywin, and you can just remove them, and you'll have nailed them already. So I definitely think he's going to be a very great card.
I think there's a couple of things. First of all, I think it's a really good design slot to say something costs 3, but its ambush cost is higher, right? Ambush cost is 5. It's a better effect. He's got a reaction for coming into the play in the challenges, but it's also always better to play a character in the challenges when your opponent can't anticipate them. So I like that we're seeing that used a couple of times now. I think we saw it on Queen's Assassin as well, as a way to make it a decision point. Because playing 3 gold for a 5 strength unique is perfectly feasible, I think, in second edition. I think it's awesome. But
and
if
I also
hold on to 5 gold, then your opponent thinks, what event, what is he going to ambush, what is he going to do? And when you finally do, or jump him in with Ariane, actually, you can jump him in with Ariane and still get the same effect.
That's exactly what I also think, that in Agot 1, for example, if you see, like, if you play against Targaryen, you see 2 influence, you're expecting either a Dragon Thief or a Dragonite or a Flamekissed. In Agot 2, it's going to be much more interesting. Because, if you have, like, 6 or 7 gold left, your opponent doesn't know. Is he going to be playing events? Is he going to be playing ambush? You know what I mean? It's much more. There are much more combinations of cards that you can be played with ambush or even the event that costs gold. So I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, no, I actually am extremely pleased that we got this one as a spoiler, because I think it ranks as one of those, like I was saying, Ariane and Gaston, phenomenal cards, and Ariahota, I think, is up there. I think you're going to be including him in every Martell deck for a long time.
Probably.
I think that's
probably
just so powerful.
Especially if you have like a way to bounce him back to your hand or something like that.
Yeah, if you had something like a Gaston Grey that worked on your own kit, yeah.
If FFG's listening.
Ways to bounce him. All right, and actually the art is quite nice too. They went for a completely different style from we've seen in the TV show and some other ones, but he still has that very recognizable big axe. You know who
exactly,
it is.
Exactly, exactly, yeah. Although, is he on a ship or something like that?
It looks like he's on a ship, yes. But does he not show up on the ship?
I don't remember exactly. You mean, yeah, the...
Because they show up to the Green Blood, but to the Royal, or whatever, to the river. And then Ariel is there.
It's actually exactly before he beheads Aris Okar, I guess.
which is the perfect moment, right? That's... You're looking up at him as if you were Aris Okar.
Kind of in conclusion, I'd really say that I really like the Martell cards. I mean, you know, when I first heard about Aga 2, I was like, oh no, and the card was going to be boring and stuff, but... As they started spoiling cards, I really got excited. And I don't know, I think it's going to be awesome.
I think that for experienced people who like to, I won't say break the game, but people who like to really push the game to its limits, I suspect the first year is going to be a little hard to get through because of the smaller card pool, right?
Definitely.
You're not going to have as many choices. You're just going to be getting familiar with the mechanics and building different kinds of decks and seeing what works, but... There won't be four different Martell decks.
Of course not. Of course not. But you know, I think that the treaty mechanic they made for each house makes the deck building possibilities quite interesting. I mean, if you think about the core box from Aggot 1, it was like really terrible. And now we might be able to build more than one deck from every house, and it's gonna be nice, I think. And there are gonna be many possibilities, and it's gonna take some time for the meta to figure out which decks work, which don't work, and stuff. So we'll definitely have some time to play and enjoy it.
I think so, and it looks like they're really pushing to get the first cycle out fast, because we already have titles for all six chapter packs. They've already given us a spoiler article for the first one. Well, thanks very much for joining us, Alex. I hope Martell lives up to your expectations. I hope all houses live up to people's expectations, except Greyjoy. I hope they exceed my expectations, and that would be perfect.
Well, thank you very much, mate.
All right, so as I mentioned earlier in the cast, we have a complete invasion of German guests this week. This is the second of three. So that Ratatosker on the boards, or Helmut, who was previously on the show a couple of times, once notably to talk about localization of the game into the German language card pool, and also known as a bit of a rules lawyer. So why would I bring a bit of a rules lawyer and not have John on the show? Why might I have such a ulterior motive?
Yeah, I wouldn't know. I'm very sad that Tron couldn't be part of this conversation, because it's going to be a dandy, and I'm really sad that he's missing out on it. But thank Alex that you invited me back on here to talk about the one thing I love the most in the world, and that is rules, of course. I mean, I know you thought I was going to say Game of Thrones, but no.
Definitely okay. The rules. Obviously, having seen this rules document now, you know, my name is in there somewhere. You've been working with the Quill and Tankers regulars, so this is not the first time you've seen this rules document. But this is the first time that it's been released. This is the first time we've seen the Learn to Play guides and the rules reference out to the general public. So are there any first things that you'd want to jump into or you know, first impressions from the way the community has reacted?
Yeah, well, maybe I could tell you my first impression when you open the rules reference. So the more detailed and more technical one of the two documents, then there's this text box that really jumps out of you at the beginning, and it says in red letters, it says "Halt." Do not read this document, it basically says. Do not read this book before you have played like 200 games. And of course, I did not obey. I read it from cover to cover. And I must say, I really liked it. It was a very riveting reading for me. Edge of your seat entertainment, really.
I do think that first warning there, halt, should be taken seriously. I don't think this document for most people is intended to be read cover to cover the way you're describing. I think the Learn to Play guide, I'm extremely happy. Winkit does a really good job of teaching the game. Everything you need to know is there, except when you read the rules reference, the first thing it tells you is maybe go check the appendices. And really, that's the timing charts, and that rounds out the game. Most of the rest of the entries is for when something goes horribly wrong in your game and you're wondering, wait a second, does Waking the Dragon's blasting effect happen before or after the reaction to the end of the phase, and you're not sure, and you look up reaction, or you look up end of phase, or you look up something like that, and you have your answer there. And, you know, whether it stands up to play is going to have to see once people start playing. Do people find the entries they're looking for?
See, Alex, I was going to come to the criticism, but I wanted to extol your virtues first, you know, because I really think you did a very good job with the new rules. As I said, I'm somebody who really was into the first edition rules of the game. And when I read the book, I saw what you did with a lot of these little things, you know, the things that always bugged me about first edition. And you cleaned a lot of those things up admirably. But the other thing you said is also very true. It makes for very technical reading. It's the wording is very exact. The warning in the beginning of the book is really, really necessary for a lot of people, because I think if you give this rule book to a newbie, then their eyes will gloss over very quickly. And at times I wish there would have that there were space for more examples, maybe, for example. I realized that you had to stay within the limitations of pages. So maybe we can do that on the forums or on the Cool and Tech and Regulars at some point.
Right. There has to be a job for you guys.
Exactly, yeah. So, for example, the one entry that was really the worst in a way for me was the triggering condition entry. I'm fond of this very technical, very terse reading, you know, but this one was too much even for me. When I read it for the first time, I was going over it like three times.
There is a point I want to make about technical wording, because this is, I mean, in being involved in this document, and I was not, you know, Nate is involved in the rules, and Mike Early were involved in the rules, and Kevin Thompson, K Tom, and Patrick Brennan, and myself. I certainly can't claim credit. But what I got most out of it, aside from many hours of lost sleep and waking up in the middle of the night and going, wait, shit, did we completely break the game? And having this moment of panic where I would look up whether something, you know, one of the best examples of that, and this gets into what I'm talking about with technical wording, is that there are a lot of words that you would use to describe something in English that you can't use when you're describing the rules terminology. So, for instance, maybe the best way for me to tell you how a certain thing works would be to use the word cannot. Mm-hmm. But that word is sacred in the rules book, right? I cannot use the word cannot, except where the rules really, really justify it. So you'll find a lot of may nots or will nots or things like that, rather than using the simplest term, because there are technical terms. Another example of that is then. Then is a word that comes up all the time in the English language, and it's almost impossible to describe rules without talking about the word then. Then again, using the word then, the word then is a defined rules term. So you have to strike a balance somewhere where you have to assume that sometimes you just need to write the explanation for the rule in English, and the word then doesn't mean what it means in game terms, and sometimes you need to be extremely careful, and the word cannot always has to mean what it means in game terms. And sort of trying to describe rules text in English, if you can think of rules text as a sort of formal logic thing, whenever it appears on a card, it's always rules text, it's not English. But when it appears in the rules documents, you need to put more context and use more words. That's probably the hardest part, and the part where I'm most worried. You know, did I put an extra cannot somewhere, or did we change a wording to something that really breaks it just to make it simpler to explain?
Exactly, this thing is something that really marred the old 1.0 FAQ. The classical example is passive abilities that trigger, you know, and it really shows that you went to great lengths to avoid this kind of thing. I think that work is going to be lost on a lot of people, but that's beside the point. But it really shows that you really lost a lot of sleep and put a lot of effort into avoiding this kind of situation. But I'm also sure that you are going to lose a lot more sleep when small mistakes or inconsistencies will be revealed during gameplay that I'm sure have to be still in there. You know?
I'm sure so, they still are.
This is unavoidable in a document of this level of complexity. So I'm looking forward to playing the game with these new rules, but I have to also say I'm not entirely convinced that it is going to be less complex in some parts. For example, the Moribund rules are gone. I never had a problem with them. I like them. The fact that I know them better than my opponents won me a bunch of important games in my Game of Thrones career. But I'm really not sure if this whole interrupt timing structure and the nested effects is going to be that much easier than the old Moribund rules, because they were there for a reason, you know?
It's worth keeping in mind that the interrupt rules at their base, so the idea of cancels and leave play effects being phrased as interrupts, has existed and been tested in other games like Star Wars and Conquest. The difference here is saves. Saves don't exist in either of those games, and so there had to be a new timing condition for that. And that's the one that will probably make the most head scratching. I hope that most of the time it works out the way people expect it. You know, if the effect is canceled, you don't need to save the character, and if you've saved the character, it's too late to cancel the effect. Mm. Hopefully that's fairly stable. And then the other way as well, if you've saved the character, then you can't trigger his leave play effect, and if you triggered his leave play effect, you can't trigger the save. That's sort of the other part of it that hopefully works every time. And I say hopefully. Admittedly, that's also the part that I wouldn't say most nervous. Okay, I will say most nervous about, because it involved a lot of entries in the rules reference to get that to a point where I hope it's airtight.
But I'm not convinced that it's going to be very easy to understand for people who don't feel like getting into the minutiae of the timing structure and the rules. So, of course, we're always going to have people asking very, very basic questions, and people, players that are unable to resolve basic timing situations because they don't feel like getting into stuff, you know.
There is an interesting point of omission in the rules that I sort of wanted to hear someone else's. There's a lot of things that are not stated in the rules, and that you might think maybe they have to be. And these are things like, you can look at your hand at any time. Mm. You can't look at your deck at any time. You can't look at your opponent's hand at any time. You can't look at your opponent's deck at any time. You know, you can't look at your plot deck at any time. Mm. And a lot of these come from a lot of other card games, right? It doesn't matter whether you're playing Bridge or War or whatever, you know, with a typical deck of cards, there's some of these same rules. But that's an example of how the rules really aren't complete, and they never will be. And if they listed all these things, they'd be tedious. But the trouble is that maybe some of the things that the people writing the rules take for granted are not the things that all the users will. And so that can cause conflicts.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, when I was reading the document, some points I thought, well, maybe at this point now they are too detailed. It's really not necessary to add this or that. For example, against, when you defined what against, a challenge against means, I thought, well, this is pretty much self-explanatory. You don't need this in the rules. But then, funny enough, in the same week as the rules reference got published, somebody asked exactly the same thing on the forums. So
that's right. They wanted to know if it needs to work both ways, or it only works when you were attacking. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And on the other point, that you cannot include all these basic rules and understandings that you have in a card game, you know, that you cannot look at your opponent's deck just like that. This doesn't have to be defined, really. But these things are coming up on the forums. For example, that the used plot pile is open information. It's obviously open information for all of us, all the old players, all the card game players. But the point has in fact come up on the forums, if it's open in information or not, because it doesn't say anywhere that it is. Mm-hmm. Whereas it says that that pile and this card will open information. And so this thing is an unintended consequence of this level of detail that you are providing in the rules text, you know, because you are giving this level of detail. So people expect this level of detail, you know.
That's right. If we were sloppier, we'd get away with it.
In a way, sure. It's a good thing, and it's necessary to be this exact, but the consequence is that people are getting used to it, and then all the players are getting more rules lawyery in a way.
Yeah, it's true, actually. The use pile thing that you mentioned is actually something that, when that came up as a question, I said, well, obviously. And then I looked through the rules. I said, okay, we haven't answered that. And then I checked the first edition rules. It's nowhere in the first edition rules either. I mean, yeah. Technically, we don't know whether the use pile is open information or not. Except we do. We know the convention. We know how it's played. We know that you've revealed it as previous information. We know that the discard and dead pile are. So we play it that way. But yeah, that kind of thing, I think that's a good example of it, you know, backfiring a little. Although there are some fun things to note, I think, where I do find something that backfires. I like to call them moment of panics as well, which I've used for pretty much everything in the rule book. But sometimes if you read through an entry, you'll find like a line that you'll say, why did they add the, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. One of them, for instance, is what happens if the first player gets eliminated in a melee game?
Mm-hmm.
Who gets the first player token? Okay, intuitively, it makes perfect sense for it to go to the next player. But that had to be somewhere, especially since now you can mill people out and all these other things. You know, this is one of those, I woke up in the middle of the night and said, oh, right, we need a rule for that.
Yeah, sure.
So, now, the last sort of thing I'd like to talk about is that we've obviously gone through this rules document at some depth, and I think that the Quill and Tank as regular has done a superb job of drawing attention to most of the rule changes that will matter for play, for everyday play. You know, I think if you reread the Learn to Play guide and you've read the Quill and Tank as regular articles, you'll be set to go on. But are there any other rule changes that sort of jumped up at you that you think are worth drawing attention to on this cast, or ones that surprised you or you want to go a little bit more in depth into?
I was actually thinking about a few things that I see as missed chances here, because most of the things that I didn't like about first edition, you cleared that up admirably and very well, but there are some things that I wish were dealt with, but they're still there. Generally, I always think that a rule that is not followed in practice is a bad rule. And we have a few of those in the first edition. For example, in practice, nobody ever chooses a first player before setup. And I don't really think it's that necessary to have this rule, maybe. Or maybe it is now, then you have to tell me about it. And then you have these divergence between the rules and how the game is played in practice. Yeah. And I don't think that's a good thing.
I think I know exactly what you mean. I think that was, for instance, one of the driving forces behind moving stealth to declaring when you declare attackers.
Exactly.
That's how
exactly
most people were playing it. The case of doesn't justify it. I agree with you now that you mentioned it. It's a good point. But there are more cases in second edition where it will matter. And that's things like the fact that most attachments have setup, which means that when you reveal your setup hand, you choose where your attachments go and your opponent chooses where his attachments go. And you need some way of resolving that conflict, because where you put your attachments might change based on where he puts his. And so that's something that already exists in first edition, and it already is a reason for first player being first player. It's just happened so infrequently because there were so few attachments and very few of them were set up. In second edition, the more attachments and more setup attachments you have, the more often that fringe little scenario where you go, we're both setting up an attachment, and if he sets his up on that character, then I'd rather have mine on this one. That situation is why it's still going to matter, but it's still a fringe situation. So I can definitely see what you mean about there might have been a cleaner way to handle that, the way that everyone would play it. Hit me with another one. Prove me wrong again.
This is a bit more complicated, but it's a very common occurrence in 2.0, and it has always bugged me no end. And this is the end of an action window. You know, the action window ends after all players consecutively pass, right? That has always been the rule, that is still the rule. But this leads to very awkward situations where there's also a very big divergence between how the game is supposed to be played according to the rules and how the game is played in reality. In reality, a marshalling phase is like, I kneel this to reduce that character, then I pay 2 gold to play that character, and then I kneel this and whatever. And then I'm done, and then it's your turn. You know. So this is the normal marshalling. What is not done is, I kneel this. Do you have an action? No. Then I kneel that. Do you have an action? No. So
unless you're playing against choke. In which case,
you are playing against Chokov. But then the situation is this, that when the second player does his marshal, then what the other players do is they pass implicitly. All these action windows in between, where the opponents have and do something, they are implicitly, they pass implicitly, the opponents, you know. But then there's the situation, then the second player says, I'm done with marshalling. The opponent has passed implicitly, and that means the phase ends at this point. And then how everybody does it is, if they have a dissension in hand, and they, of course they want to play their dissension, then they say, oh, now I play dissension on your ally there. This is not allowed. The situation it shouldn't come up because they have implicitly passed.
Yeah, I can't really state otherwise. I mean, I think you're right in that that is a major disconnect between the rules and the way people play. I think that it's a difficult situation to resolve in, I mean, it's easy in timing structures like Netrunner, where you have a limited number of actions controlled by clicks in the economy there. But here, where you really are doing this alternating action phenomenon, doubling the number of passes in theory slows the game down. In practice, it doesn't, because no one's doing that anyway. So I'm not sure that solution fixes it either. I will say that there are cards that make this a bigger problem than others. So, for instance, Ice Fisherman or Dissension are examples of cards that make this a much bigger problem. And if you look at the closest thing we have to Ice Fisherman in second edition, which is a meager contribution, which steals a gold from your opponent, you'll notice that it's a reaction to the opponent counting marshalling. So it automatically makes it clear that you're not trying to force people to play that game, where you're waiting for the first player who's doing this and then so on. It makes the timing much more explicit. So I can't say that the rules have fixed that, or that the cards have fixed that, because I have no idea in the long run. But I can't say that there was a conscious effort to try and limit the situations where that kind of play event would happen.
That's really good to hear, because this is the second place where this fix can take place. The one would be in the rules themselves, and the other one is in card design. You know, just don't let situations like that come up. But then the design team has to be like conscious
vigilant,
of this,
yeah.
this thing also in the future. But yeah, it's great to hear that these things are taken into consideration. A third thing that has always bugged me is something. What we will have to wait for the tournament rules to see how it really shakes out. But you also have forced interrupts, forced reactions in the second edition rule set. We don't have passives anymore, and I'm really, really thanking my creator for this, that passives are gone, but forced interrupts, forced reactions take the role of passives in some contexts. And there's one thing I always hated about first edition, and that was that passives must happen and are the responsibility of all players, you know, because this totally goes against the grain for competitive players. It goes against their instincts that they are responsible for positive, for things to happen that are positive for their opponent and that their opponent might forget. So what you are creating there is a situation where you more or less lure the competitive players into cheating de facto, because it is not policeable. You know, you cannot police this kind of thing. You cannot.
I can't really, again, it's a valid point. I think it's probably, and I can't speak from this from any authority at all. I really want to make that clear. I think this is a balance of approachability versus not, and it's not necessarily fair, but it's hard to make the assumption that your opponent will know every card that you have in a casual or local setting.
Mm-hmm.
It is hard to say, okay, it is your responsibility to trigger the negative effects on my cards.
Mm-hmm.
And that forced interrupt simply means that you, as my opponent, can trigger them, but not that I'm forced to. I think that, that puts a lot of burden on the opponent that might not be nice at the sort of initial stages of the game. At the highly competitive scene, I could see that being phrased differently. I don't know what the justification there is. I prefer playing the game however it's meant to be played, and I like lines, but that it is the responsibility of all players to ensure that a fun game happens, right? That you and your opponent are in this sort of dialogue making something interesting happening. I like that philosophy of play, but I also really don't like the idea that we are encouraging cheating, or that we are implicitly endorsing cheating, or that we are explicitly endorsing cheating, as the case may be. So I think you have a very valid point there.
It's certainly not endorsing cheating, but it's putting a burden on the competitive player that should not be his to bear. You know, it should not be on the competitive player to remind their opponent of effects that are beneficial for the opponent.
Now, there are a couple rules that I wanted to mention that I think maybe people have glossed over that I think might be worth drawing attention to. And the first is that there's an entry on the redirect in challenges, and that's only a melee relevant thing. So some of you are already falling asleep, but that's
I'm
not fair.
Them.
But the redirect now, when you use it, does not force the redirected the player whose challenge was redirected to respect supports or any other restrictions on his challenge. So this was one of the aspects that made three player games very, very annoying. Because sometimes, you know, you couldn't use a redirect at all because there was no other target for it, and it made other things quite difficult. Here, that means that the redirect can also be used as a trick to specifically allow someone to make a challenge they weren't otherwise able to make, and you can use it as a bargaining chip. I think that will see a fair bit of use, and I think it will be very interesting without adding too much complexity or anything like that. So I'm quite pleased with that particular change.
I'll not claim that I'm any sort of expert on the melee game, but I know this. Anything that adds more bargaining chips and more interaction to the melee game is a good thing. So thumbs up on that one.
And then the last one that I thought might be worth mentioning, I don't think it matters for anything right now, and I won't say whether it was intentional or unintentional, but it turns out that challenges don't end when no characters are participating. This may sound like a big deal. In most cases, it's not, because generally you would use, if you wanted the challenge to maintain, they would declare their attackers, you would declare your defenders, and then you'd remove their attackers so that you'd win on defense anyway. So that's not much of a difference. But if there are future naval or characters that can jump into challenges that have already been initiated, it might make a difference down the road. So it's certainly one to keep an eye on. That means that if a challenge was initiated, it will go all the way to resolution unless a card effect stops it.
I'm glad you're mentioning this one, because I think it's a great example of what I suppose the design team set out to do. I always thought these rules were very clear and easy to understand about when a challenge fizzles, as we call it, or when a challenge goes to resolution. But it is a point that was asked a lot, and people were really unsure about it.
Right. So I am going to – that's pretty much all I had. I don't know if you have any other last thoughts or things you wanted to close off on. I did want to mention, if you do have rules questions, there is a rules forum. It's getting answered regularly. There's lots of people involved in it. The Card Game DB rules forum right now is the place that I'm most frequently frequenting. That was not an awkward sentence at all. So check it out. All right, so as promised, I am now joined by my third German, as well as my second German. So Helmut is here still, and we're joined by Florian Maas to talk about the FAQ, to talk about some 1.0 content. So welcome, Florian.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Florian.
The first thing I'd like to start with, normally I like to start with the article, but here I want to start with the timing. This came out 2 weeks before your Gen Con deck has to be locked in. If you're flying into Gen Con on the Wednesday, this was 2 weeks before. I don't know why I arbitrarily think that should be at least 3 weeks. I don't know where I have that number. I just feel 2 weeks is way too short. As people who are not attending Gen Con, what is your feel behind that?
It will benefit players who have a better understanding of the game overall, because they need less time to figure out a new meta. And it will also benefit those who have known about the contents of the FAQ earlier than it was released. I know a few guys, and I don't think that's fair. So there's a plus side to it, and there's a negative side to it, and I can't really make out on which side I'm going to settle down in the end.
I think that's a valid point as well. If these FAQs are playtested, then giving some people only 2 weeks notice and other people much longer, if the difference is 4 weeks or 6 weeks or whatever, then fine. The magnitude isn't as large, but here, you know, presumably this was decided on a little while ago. I don't know what the actual date on the FAQ says. It's generally a pretty good indicator. What does it say? It says the 24th of June. So, okay. They have a 2 week lead, so they had double the time to start thinking about this, presumably.
Absolutely. You have the same kind of problem when new cards enter the meta, when the time is very short between the release of the new cards and the tournament. Also, the playtesters have a huge advantage. Generally, my first impulse would be to say, well, deal with it. This is the Game of Thrones, and you win or you die. But, of course, Florian has a point that it's not really fair. What are you going to do? It's what it is.
It is what it is, and... So starting with the article, because I think it sets an interesting tone, there seems to be this idea of, I took a couple of the decks that were performing fine or well, a couple of the decks that people were complaining about, we knocked those down a peg, and then a couple that weren't doing all that well, we didn't touch. It really looks like they were looking at the meta, or at least looking at the annals, and then said, you know, Lanny's doing fine, and Targ's doing fine, and this is doing fine, but we want to change up something, so we'll get rid of a card for Lanny, we'll get rid of a card for Targ. Barrow's not doing too well, so we won't touch them. I mean, I think, Florin, you coined it a term. You said that it was a populist FAQ?
Yeah, I would say so. And I want to disagree and bring a counterpoint to what you just said, that they looked at the annals and made that the foundation of their decision. Because they hit boats really hard, and those decks don't really show up in the annals. They're at like 4% or something like that, not dominant at all. So from that standpoint, I don't really understand the decision.
Yeah, you're right. Longship Maiden's Bane is only the restricted of 15% of Greyjoy overall right now, and 20% in the cut. So it was a deck that people didn't like playing against, but you're right. It, as a factor in the annals, I think it was more that people were whining about it, which might reinforce the term populist FAQ. But then again, I kind of get the feeling that the last few FAQs have generally responded to popular outcry, and they seem to have worked out fairly well for the meta. People say that we're very, very balanced stages of the meta.
I tend to agree. I really liked the last couple FAQ updates, and they also had this populist feel for them. We mustn't forget that the designers have other things on their minds right now than playtesting a new FAQ, I assume at least. So I don't even blame them if they take a shortcut here and there and just look at popular opinion and give people what the designers think they want. I think it worked out very well the two previous updates, but I'm really unhappy about this one, about some aspects of this one, I must say, because Hyperneal decks were a force to reckon with, but they were not dominant by a long shot. And the restriction of Harry, I think, took Hyperneal as a deck type out of the equation in a way, so that made the meta poorer. And boats kind of is the same thing.
Well, before we jump into the finer details of the FAQ itself, I just wanted to go really, really briefly over a change in the tournament rules. Most people, this won't matter at all. Basically, the only change in there is that they let themselves and the tournament rules use the new tournament software, which is a different way of breaking strength of schedule ties, or of calculating strength of schedule and breaking ties, record ties. So basically, the tournament organizers are obliged to tell you which method they're using, but that's the only difference there, is that they describe that other method. So I think it probably is a better method. We've talked about it in the past, so we won't go into any details there. It's nice to see that they acknowledge that in the rules, although I don't think anyone would have been upset if they had come to Gen Con and say, by the way, we're using a different strength of schedule method than is listed in the book. If you built your deck based on the strength of schedule calculation, you had other problems.
Probably. Oh, you're really, really good at the game.
So, the FAQ itself. Well, let's start off with the first one. Florian, do you want to give us the first one?
Yeah. It's an erratum to fleeing to the wall. And it just says that fleeing to the wall cannot be cancelled anymore. Which makes sense, because I don't think that was an intended interaction in the first place. It's sort of... they carried over the other's trade from the CCG, I believe. And I think they just missed the interaction with the Green Seer's Raven. And fleeing to the wall, as Drakey called it, is one of the hidden linchpins of the meta that sort of keeps decks that play a lot of locations and try to stall the game and then wipe the board, win the game with their locations. Fleeing to the wall keeps that in check, and it's really important that it cannot be cancelled and cannot easily be played around, because then you have always this one plot you can rely on to fix the meta if it swings in that direction. So that makes sense.
I think I agree with you. I think that this erratum will make very little difference to the number of people playing this plot. I think if you really needed it or were building your deck around it, you're going to be doing it anyway. And I don't think it'll make much of a difference. I think you'll wind up with the same amount of people playing it before and after. But when you view it as a controlling effect for the entire meta and the future, although the future of the game is fairly short, I can definitely see why they made that change, despite the fact that it's an erratum.
I'm not even sure I agree that it's not going to make that big a difference. Hard to assess how big the difference is, but I think there's an incentive for a lot of decks to run Fleeing to the Wall at this point, and I can well imagine that some of those players might have not included it for fear of the Green Seer Raven, and they might include it now. It remains to be seen, but I think this entry is one of the ones that are not talked about much now, but might prove influential. More influential than we think right now, maybe.
Or less influential because, well, you get rid of all the influence with it.
Ha, ha, ha. On that note, Helmut, would you care to give us the next entry?
Longship Mainsbane should read, X is the number of unique Greyjoy Warship cards you control. And I think this is the one point where we might jump ship and go to the other
Greyjoy.
Maybe I should read Naval Escort at this point too.
Sure, yeah.
Naval Escort, the second effect should read any phase, kneel Naval Escort and any number of unique warship locations to choose X characters. Each of those characters gets plus X strength until the end of the phase. X is the number of locations just knelt. Yeah, it's a very similar erratum to both of these cards. They only work with unique warships now. And I think these two cards are neutered now.
I think they really have been neutered. I do want to point out that they're not exactly the same errata, because one of them is unique Greyjoy warships and the other one is unique warships. One of them has also, the naval escort has gained the fact that you have to kneel it, but that it'll count itself despite not being a unique warship. I think these are clunky. I'm not really all that sad to push Greyjoy in another direction. I think it has other directions to go, so fine, but I already don't like errata, even at the end of this game where it's not really a barrier to entry. And I think that if you were going to, you could have just made both of them unique warships or whatever it is, rather than have them subtly different so you have to remember two completely different errata. But then again, I don't think you have to remember them. I don't think either of these will see play.
It's exactly. Been mentioned.
A reaction to popular outcry. It does the job. It does what people wanted. It does more than what people wanted. It completely kills the archetype. So maybe that's what people wanted.
It's not even a popular outcry, I believe. I think it was only... was it the NYC meta complaining?
It was mostly DC, NYC, but a lot of...
yeah, DC.
I mean, it also won in California a couple times. It was a pretty fearsome deck. The version that I played against a couple of times was very, very hard to play against. So let's go to perhaps the most interesting, I think, erratum. And that's Mira Reed being swapped from an any phase ability to pull her out of shadows to a response to pulling her out of shadows. This has massive implications. It cleans up a bunch of rules, so you can tell that I might even be happy. And that's nice in and of itself. It also means that you're rarely going to be able to pull her out in marshalling for whatever the reason, which means that she's more vulnerable to King's Law. It means that she can't be blanking income locations, like I'm sure Florian has told me he often did with his Grand Theft Location deck. It also makes it much harder to time that sort of surprise blanking for the worst potential moment, although if your opponent was surprised when you pulled Mirror Read out of Shadows. And it makes it impossible to use her twice in a phase, which is another significant constraint. I like this errata. I like it a lot. I also like the fact that Mirror Read remains completely playable and a completely valid restriction choice despite that.
I'm not a fan, but I'm biased, most likely because I've just been playing this deck too much. It hurts. Makes me mirror weep.
Yeah, I think it does make the Dark No Agenda deck significantly worse. Another interaction that is not possible anymore now is the Mira Aria combination that was very popular also. And I'm not sure how much worse Dark No Agenda is because of it now. There were voices in the meta that said that Stark NA was by far the best deck. I'm not sure about that, but I'm sure that it's not the best deck in the meta anymore now. So if it's still viable, again, it has to be seen. I weep a little bit for Mira because it was such a fun card to play around. It was so flexible. You could do so many unexpected things with her ability. It's gone now, and I think we're poorer for it. Basically, nah, I'm not going to say it's a balanced card. Everybody will kill me.
It is not. It was overpowered before. I think yes. It's still way above power curve now, especially considering that it has she has stealth and an intrigue icon, which is just bonkers in stock. I actually believe that if we are going to see the champion cards in the new edition, this Mirror Read comes much closer to what I expect to be designed for the second edition.
I think I agree.
With a response and maybe without stealth, and she costs a little more, and then we're in the realm of possibility.
So, I mean, I guess Florian is probably one of the better people to ask. So do you think the Stark No Agendas still use Mira? Do they use it only if they're running Winter? Do they definitely use it if they're running Winter, and maybe if they're not?
It depends, because a lot of GTL actually hinged on Mira, because she blanks, she gets, obviously she blanks Star, but she gets rid of income providers, she makes you resilient to resets, and she just can answer every card, which is very important in a toolbox-oriented deck. I don't know if Stark NA is actually viable right now. It's weird. So if Stark NA is viable, I still think that Mirror Read will be the go-to restricted choice there. But I've also seen Stark Knights decks, for example, that would run other restricted cards then. For example, Preston Greenfield, Fearbringer, something like that. So it's opened up the pool for Stark, which I think is a good thing, because before that, you were playing Mira all of the time.
All right. So moving on. So we've got the restricted list, and this is, smallish changes, 3 cards on, 3 cards off. We briefly discussed them a little bit already, so maybe they're best discussed together. I don't know. I feel like Harry and To Be a Dragon and the Red Viper were put on the list for the same reasons. Again, the Red Viper seems to me like a sort of a populist choice. I don't disagree with it. The Red Viper is a phenomenal character, and I like the fact that in a sort of pre-Gen Con FAQ, you're telling people, hey, at least have another look at that Martell No Agenda and think about building it slightly differently. And another change as well, a card that came off does that as well. Does it really hurt Martell that much? Does it really boost them that much? They were the house that was winning the least, but they were performing mostly fine in the cuts and the like. I think overall for Martell, it's a wash, and I don't think I will miss seeing a little less Red Viper out there and seeing some other restricted choices. So I think that one is successful. I think To Be a Dragon and Harry the Riverlands were too easy to include, so I can't actually complain too much about their addition either.
That's the wrong precedent, though, because now the whiners are just going to continue whine all the way through second edition, because they know if you just whine long enough, if we whine for 4 years, they will finally restrict it.
The Red Viper.
I should just start whining about the Rose Road right now.
So, for instance, there are other sort of second-order interactions that are pretty important to consider. So Harry the Riverlands going on, means that it's much less likely to be taken as a card. It may still, but I don't think very much because of the way events are treated right now. But it means that Westerlands becomes weaker. And I think Westerlands was actually causing a problem in that it was giving really easy location control to a house that traditionally that was one of their biggest weaknesses. And by removing Harry but not removing Westerlands, you've still given them that option, but they have to work for it. And I think that's good.
I think that's really
a good place to see Lannister.
Between city plots and condemned by the council, it was fine, I'd say.
I have found Westerlands to be fairly devastating overall.
I mean, yeah, Westerlands is obviously miles better than just having two activations with a city plot and condemned by the council. But I think the location hate problem is not obvious to me. I mean, it was important against the boats deck, but that deck doesn't exist anymore.
Well, it's important against Targ, which does exist right now.
I think we're in a meta where pretty much every house can do pretty much anything or has tech for pretty much every to control every card type, more or less. So I'm not surprised to see Lenny have this one card that is good versus locations. Yeah, it's a very strong card, but I have not experienced it to be that much of a problem.
And then to be a dragon, I think, was, again, every single Targ deck was opening with the 4-8-1 King's Landing coup. And I think that the meta is poorer when that is the case, and that by getting to be a dragon as a still probably valuable restricted choice, because you get the stand even in the presence of cancel, I think that that makes the meta richer. So I think this is an example where I can get behind all three additions to the restricted list.
To be a dragon hurts a lot of very good Stark builds right now. So I think it's a quite obvious choice. I don't think we have talked about the Red Viper enough. At least I would mention one more point, because you asked if it's going to make Martell weaker. And I think one of the best Martell decks right now is, of course, No Agenda Quentin. And I'm not sure the restriction of the Red Viper hurts that deck that much, because my impression has always been that Venomous Blade or the Viper's Bannermen are very good, nice-to-have cards for that deck, but I have never felt they were absolutely necessary there. And that deck also gets access to another very good card via Unrestriction. So I think overall this FAQ might have maybe even helped particular deck.
I would argue that with Martell Alufin apart, which again for other reasons is going to be probably fairly strong, and that Martell No Agenda, which has always been a force to be reckoned with, I think there's a reasonable case to be made to not use the Viper as you're restricted. And I think I could easily build it one way or the other, and I think that's better than the current version where that was automatic. And I, you know, if there's a chance that I might see the nice Warcrest Viper played against me, that would be nice. I like that card. It's a fun card. There's a chance that I might see the other Noble Crest Viper played against me. That would be amazing.
Okay. That would really be amazing. Wow.
Just for the Gaston Grey interaction, I guess.
Yeah.
And Florian, what do you think about the Viper?
So the standard mode for Quentin is just going to be, I'm still playing the Viper, but I replace the Venomous Blade with Game of Savas. I think that is the easiest choice you can make. And then if you're feeling fancy, you can leave the Red Viper at home. But I don't think that is a good choice, actually, because you don't have enough event and attachment slots anyway.
Well, Venomous Blades can be set up.
I actually wanted to make a point about Targaryen, because I think that the To Be a Dragon restriction will shift the house back from a more aggro-oriented house back to a control-oriented house. Because what To Be a Dragon really did was power these very character-based decks that use Daenerys to control the board and then just push through.
Or the new Khal Drogo or Pyre Kree,
exactly.
Or whatever the case is.
And because To Be a Dragon works both ways, it both resurrects Daenerys if she dies, and you can stand her with To Be a Dragon to initiate another challenge with her. These decks are now extremely hampered. But on the other hand, we now have to focus more on the controlling side of the house again. And I think it's good that not every deck becomes this character beatdown deck. And we have different identities for the houses. And I think to be a dragon just mixed it up a little bit too much so that every house was kind of the same. So, like, Targaryen played a little bit like Stark. And now we have differences again, which is kind of nice.
So the unrestrictions, and this is probably what's garnered the most attention, are A Game of Savas, or Kivas, if you're James Walmsley, The Conclave, and Crossing the Mummer's Ford. Let's start with Crossing the Mummer's Ford, because we can address that one independently of the other two. This maintains its errata. It cannot be copied, so you cannot trigger it a second time. You're only going to get 4 or 5 cards out of it, depending on how you play it. But now it's not restricted, so you can run the river plots. Does this make it, or make the rivers return to some sort of playability?
Yeah, no.
No, I don't think so. My first impression is, nah, it's not enough to bring rivers back, because if you are going to use 3 or 4 plot choices for card advantage, then it has to be real good card advantage. But then on the other hand, I hear little birds talking into my ear that respectable players and metas are fooling around with rivers once more, so maybe I will again be proven the fool I am, and everybody is going to win everything with River Station Mount, but I really don't think so.
I do have to agree. My initial inkling was just to dismiss it still, and yeah. I've also heard similar rumblings, and you know what, if they can, fair play to them. I have not been spending any testing efforts on Crossing the Mummer's Ford specifically, and that might be my own shortcoming. It might be short-sighted, because the other river plots do things as well. And as a plot in that cycle, getting 4 cards is a phenomenal plot. So if you're getting enough out of the other plots to offset the fact that you're dedicating your whole plot deck to it, or you're getting the game to go long enough that you're reliably getting that as your sort of closing set of cards that you need, there may be something in there. There may be some fuel for combos with Nisar still giving you the additional cards as well. But I mean, you can't test everything in the 2 weeks you have before Gen Con, and this one has not entered my radar.
There's also Greasiest Raven right now, which didn't exist before. So you can't copy it. And if that one activation of Crossing the Mummer's Ford gets cancelled, your entire plot deck didn't do anything.
All right, well, Conclave and Game of Savas, you can't really discuss them separately. So let us discuss them together.
Why can't you discuss them separately? I think the Conclave is going to go in a lot more decks than Game of Savas.
True.
Because it's neutral.
I think the first place that people think of the things together was the old Martell Maesters decks, which now you could run as aloof and apart, which now you could still run as Maesters. They were very, very quick. They used a lot of Martell's control tools, and then a turn like to the Spears or Game of Thrones with the Conclaves that would just seal the game entirely. If you can get a Maester of War and 2 Conclaves on the board, you're getting a bunch of renowned challenges really, really very quickly with potent characters that were very cheap. I think that's still viable. I think I might run that out of Aloof and Apart or out of Maesters, depending. But I think that is, as it was, an extremely solid deck. I do think the meta has a few more tools to handle it, though.
Also, don't underestimate the role that the Art of Seduction played in that deck. Because it was really that one turn where your opponent couldn't follow you that helped you set up the win with 2 to Spears. And that is not around right now. You cannot play the Master's Path and Art of Seduction. So I'm a little skeptical here when it comes to that deck. I think actually Illuvian Apart might be a better home for the Conclave. Out of Martell.
Out of Martell. And then out of... I think most Illuvian Apart is probably going to be running the Conclave.
Yeah.
As a general rule. So the Conclave is probably the most radical, eye-raising change on this list of things coming off. A lot of people are going, what on earth are they thinking? In fact, to some extent, so am I. But it's also, as I said, there are more tools in the meta to handle it than there were then. You know, depends on whether people want to run anti-maester tech. They probably should be now. Things like Ygritte, they certainly can work. It's a cancelable trigger, and that means different things now than it meant then. So I think there's a case to be made that it's not quite as scary as it was, But I think the strongest case for pulling it off the list is that this is a wild card. This, of all the changes on the list, was the one I could not have predicted, and that really makes me reevaluate tons of decks here anticipating Gen Con. Gen Con was 2 weeks from this FAQ. When I saw the Conclave was coming off, that's when I said, oh, I really do have to look at a whole bunch of decks again and see whether they can handle the Conclaves, see whether they should have the Conclaves. To me, that's the one that made me rethink a whole bunch of decks. And I'm glad that there was a change.
And that's also the one that makes it a much more significant advantage if you had the information like 1 or 2 weeks earlier than everyone else.
Mm-hmm. I think the meta can handle it. I think people are kind of overreacting a bit to this unrestriction, because what I remember, I played through the first Meister time, and I really don't remember the Conclave being the one piece that made Meister decks so dominant back in the day. I even distinctly remember that not even every Meister's Path deck ran it. Don't think the Conclave is restricting the Conclave was the one piece that curbed Meister's deck, took them down a notch. The errata and the restriction of the agenda and of Tinlink were much more instrumental than that. And the meta can handle rush decks, so I'm not that worried about it.
I would agree with you somewhat, except in the case of Greyjoy. The Maesters that won Stalic that year as well.
Yes, I think they had two. Yeah,
they were. I think they were quite dependent on this. It was the only Maester they had that was first snow resilient. The only Maester they had that was burn resilient in and of itself. So against certain decks, especially Hollow Hills that were relatively common at the time, I think that the Conclaves were one of the only thing keeping them in the game.
And you see this not really relevant point of being a 5-strength intrigue character in Greyjoy.
Well, that's not as important now as it used to be. definitely the case. What about Sivas then?
Really looking forward to seeing that one again, because that was a card that was played a lot and was feared a lot. I distinctly remember discussions how people would think about running the Summer's Champion in Baratheon. 4-strength intrigue icon is so good against Sivas. So this was a card you had in mind back then. And of course, it is not as strong as it was. There's more answers to it. Decks are generally more efficient. Also, FAQ update entry 3.6. This change nerfs Sivas a little bit. It's not as flexible anymore as it used to be. I think it's a very, very strong card because it has two things. It provides you with challenge control economy. So it does those two things at the same time. So I think we're going to see quite a bit of it. Of course, there's also more events that can go into Martell's event slots than there were back when. But I think good players are going to find a very good use for this card.
It also combines very nicely with Choosing the Spear, which hasn't been around last time we had a game of Sivas. The restricted list, which I think is an interesting combination, and I wonder how that is going to play out.
It is, but do you have room for both?
You make room.
I think those are the best unrestricted events at this point.
I would.
He calls a thinking floor.
Yeah, I would have trouble not including three He Calls It Thinkings in this meta right now.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It's a huge, basically an auto include at that point. So, yeah, maybe the next three are Choosing the Spear. I don't know for sure.
And I mean, He Calls It Thinking gives plus 2 strength. So that's also pretty good with a game of Sivas.
That's true.
So maybe just 3 of each.
Now, does that mean that Martell is the new king?
You've got to put it in perspective, because Martell has a lot of good events. This doesn't really increase the quality of events very significantly. I mean, it's a very good event. No debate there, but Martell also had pretty good choices before that. So.
And events are still suffering from the same things they were suffering from before. So I think, again, if ever the meta could handle Sivas back, it is now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's certainly much easier to ditch a weenie than to kneel an important intrigue character and lose one to a bounce. So it's a pretty obvious thing to cancel with a Harrenhal.
Oh, yeah. And that's also a thing I think we haven't mentioned yet, that when the game of Savas was became restricted, other houses didn't have access to as many intrigue characters as they have now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very good point.
Now, to close off then, I would quickly go over some of the rules, but really, a bunch of them were just changes to re-clarify things that were already there, really don't change anything from the point of view of most players, and then a couple fixed how Mira Reed interacted with things now that she's a response, because she used to have lots of entries specific to her. The only new one clarifies the definition of during a challenge, so whether specifically Men of Judy and Palisades actually work on non-kneelers, for instance, or on attackers, and the answer is they don't work. And Palisades doesn't stop a non-kneeler from attacking, and Men of Duty does not allow you to attack with an icon you wouldn't otherwise have had. No one is playing Palisades, no one is playing Men of Duty, but it does matter for some other cards, I guess, that establish duration from during a challenge.
Yeah, nothing.
I'll attempt my best Dark Nush impression here.
Exactly, Jan. So you guys have a tournament in München at the end of August, which will almost certainly be under the same FAQ, but after Gen Con has sort of settled things out a little bit. How do you see things evolving from Gen Con? Is the fact that this was clearly an FAQ to change a few things up for the sake of change, but a little riskier than some other ones have been, perhaps, going to result in a very stagnant meta a few weeks down the road once it gets figured out? Is that the risk? I think we'll end on that then. Closing comments. I do want to list off some of the regionals happening this weekend. There's one in Amherst, one in Milano in Italy, one in Portland, and one in Tulsa. There's also the illustrious Battle of Blackwater Bay in the UK, in London, and that one is actually happening with the new FAQ, so it'll be the first sort of pre-Gen Con testing ground, so hopefully many of you will be watching that avidly, and I do hope they get a stream up. They did do that last year. On top of that, I do want to close off with a sort of uncertainty. We really do want to get episodes to you as regularly as possible, but our schedule as we get in the lead up to Gen Con is a bit fishy. So I hope we'll have an episode for you next week. I doubt we'll have one for the day following our return from Gen Con, although it's possible we'll get one for you later that week, or that we'll just have to skip that episode. If you want to find out in advance of when that actually happens, I'm sure we'll be posting it to our Facebook group.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
Oh, that's not my version. That's Tarkin's version, actually.
Oh, that's Tarkin's version. Oh, you're right. Sorry, wrong T. All right. Yeah. I get to cut these out and make myself sound smart in the end, so I'm fine.